This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast.
This week is a special episode of the podcast, made possible by the underwriting of New Belgium Brewing and our collaborative series called Into the Wild. Last week, New Belgium kicked off their Sour Saison blending tour starting in California, pulling this rad vintage trailer behind a pickup truck and parking it at bars and breweries across the country. I joined them for that leg of the journey, and again recently here in my hometown of Chicago. And right now, it's headed back to Denver and then Los Angeles, so you still have time to link up with the tour. One of the reasons this collaboration is so special for us is because it's helping us devote a portion of our editorial, this podcast, and our design team to a category of beers we love. Wild fermentation, sour, wood-aged, mixed firm, those beers that are keeping alive an ancient tradition for a new generation of drinkers. You can see all the content and the event schedule at goodbeerhunting.com/intothewild. In addition to the articles we've been writing, we're also publishing a print mag, which we're handing out for free at the events. And we've been able to put together some one-off podcast episodes like this one, featuring Jay Goodwin of The Rare Barrel, and Dick Cantwell, formerly of Elysian and now the owner of Magnolia Brewing, and author of numerous books on brewing. So while the taproom at The Rare Barrel was full of people sampling and blending sour saison, and Dick Cantwell was demonstrating how to take apart and rebuild an oak barrel, we got together on a small stage and struck up a conversation about the state of the category. So let's get into the wild. This is Jay Goodwin of Rare Barrel, and Dick Cantwell of Magnolia. Listen in.
Okay, everyone. I've got Jay Goodwin here of The Rare Barrel, and I've got Dick Cantwell of Magnolia, and well-known author of beer books. I want to give him a hand, yeah. We wanted to take advantage of the moment of having some folks together tasting, blending of your own volition here, and we're kind of interested to see what the results of some of that are in terms of your personal preferences and things you're learning. And I don't think there's any better way to kind of figure out what's going on in the blending of this sour and saison kind of set that you have in front of you from two different breweries that are kind of investigating that territory than to talk to these folks here about some of the, I guess, the history of brewing saison in the U.S., the history of brewing sour, and where we might be going after this. But to start, I kind of wanted to follow up on what you just did over here with us in the tearing down of that wooden barrel.
That was fun.
It's got to be like, what, the 175th barrel you've taken apart?
You know, that was the first.
How did that go?
Actually, it went pretty well. I mean, Tommy prepared me pretty well. I mean, the main hitch is that the head is going to fall in a couple of times, and it did this when we did it before this started, but just now it went just fine.
There seems to be a trick of geometry involved in that last bit there with the head, where it feels like you can't possibly put that in place and fight gravity at the same time.
Yeah, well, that little head puller thing, you think that that's going to be hard to get out, but it's not. So it's really pretty neat the way it works. It's the simplest tool.
There's a little bit of like using every part of the whale involved there, where you're literally using a piece of a barrel hoop to help construct and
right.
deconstruct a barrel.
Or feeding pigs pork.
That's even more dark. In an operation like this, Jay, at the Rare Barrel, how important is coopering skills when your entire operation is essentially reliant on the integrity of these barrels? Is that a skill set that you've had to develop in-house? Is that something you bring in? Like, how do you go about maintaining that?
We do invest a lot in the maintenance of our barrels. If you think about, most beer lives its life in stainless steel and then a glass or a can. But an oak barrel is very unique because it's a porous surface. It's a surface that lets in oxygen over time. So going about maintaining this, which is, you know, just held together, as you can see, by all these oak barrels, by just some metal rings, it's labor intensive, for sure. But it's a labor of love. But they're very difficult to maintain. You cannot clean an oak barrel completely. You cannot sterilize it. Over time, we've borrowed from our friends at New Belgium to learn how to properly maintain oak. We've made some modifications when we realized the storage solution that we were using started to lightly affect the flavor of our beers. So we went into more of a dry storage method, which involves ozonated water and steam and a pressure washer. And for a small brewery like ours, a lot of money as well goes into those those pieces of equipment. So it's an important process. I mean, the beer is going to live in there for anywhere from 6 months to many years. So taking that time up front to make sure the barrel has integrity, is clean, is going to be a proper environment for the beer is critical to the process of making a great sour beer.
I mean, anytime we talk about cleanliness when it comes to a barrel, we're obviously talking about two different kinds of things. I mean, part of the intent of a barrel is that it is living and providing some sort of microbiology climate in there, but there's desirable and undesirable. In your writing and researching of the book, Beer and Wood, or Wood and Beer, how did you go about describing some of the ways in which you can cultivate the environment of a barrel rather than just using it to replace stainless?
Well, as you point out, there's a difference between desirable characteristics the wood can harbor and undesirable. I mean, just the fact that it's not literally clean does not mean that it's dirty.
Right.
It means that it's alive. So, you can cultivate that any number of ways. I mean, I'm really looking forward to doing some of that inoculation with the Oud-Beersel beer that we're going to be bringing in from Belgium. And we'll put that in wood, and that will be what that wood will be from then on. It'll be influenced by whatever microbiological constituent that beer has. And, I'm sure, Jay, I mean, this we're looking at many dozens and hundreds of different little microflora environments in each of these barrels. And, I mean, it's just like you kind of have to let go. I mean, you have to recognize that what you're doing is not entirely within your control, although you try to make the best choices you can. Some of the things that Jay was just talking about, the currying the environment so it is advantageous for it. There's just so much to think about, but also you can't overthink it.
Growing up, I just have to steal your phrase there, Dick, because I would tell my parents all the time, they'd say, "Your room isn't clean," and I would say, "It's not literally clean, but that doesn't mean it's dirty."
So you made piles.
Yes.
It brings up an important point, I think, about where these barrels even come from to begin with. They obviously weren't coopered and created here. They came from other places. They had lives before they showed up at your doorstep. How influential is the life of a barrel before it shows up here on what eventually comes out of that barrel when your beer goes into it?
Well, most of the barrels we use here at the Rare Barrel have seen a life involving wine, usually several uses making different varietals of red wine in California. We prefer that the winemakers use these barrels many times to strip out a lot of the intense oak character. And that's what they want for their wines. We want maybe a light background note of oak. So sour beer making is very expensive, but one of the only things that actually we get a good price on is oak barrels. Number one, because we're so close to winemaking country, but also because we're looking for an oak barrel that has been stripped of its oak by winemakers, and it's basically a waste product for them at that point. And that's exactly when we want the oak barrel. That being said, and the little background on that, the reason for that is we want to experiment more on the fermentation side of things. What flavors are we driving from the different yeast and bacteria and ingredients we're introducing into our beers? And what flavors do those produce? And we're trying to take copious notes on that and learn what makes a good sour beer. One issue I saw when we started the Rare Barrel was that, we could get, maybe we have access to wonderfully freshly emptied wine barrels, and that wine would influence the character of the beer. But at that point, it's a little confusing because how do you interpret a great beer that you've made? Is this mostly the wine character, or was it our fermentation experiment? So we started off pretty neutral. That being said, there are special oak barrels out there. That's a big part of our ethos here at the Rare Barrel. In fact, our name is named after an oak barrel that lived at New Belgium a couple of different times.
It's called, played a significant role in your history.
Yep, called PH1. Shout out to PH1. which is now over at Purpose Brewing in Fort Collins with our friend Peter Buchart, who I guess also had some part of writing the book.
Yeah.
So you can get this one oak barrel that maybe combines a special blend of yeast and bacteria that makes wonderful beer, and that's what we're looking to do just over and over again. So we have lots of loss here. We're trying to find that combination that works and makes great beer, and then try to have that barrel, have that process influence what the rest of we do going forward to try and always improve our process.
Actually, in the book, we had, can I just jump in with?
Of course.
In the book, we had two chapters devoted to the flavors that you might get from a barrel. One of which dealt with the flavors that oak contributes, the different flavors that oak contributes that Jay is talking about, having been minimized by repeated use in a winery, at which point it becomes desirable to use for these purposes. And the other is flavors. That one was called Flavors from Wood. The other chapter was called Flavors in Wood. And that's the microbiology of it.
Just from a fundamental level, that's kind of an elementary question, but I think the explanation is kind of broad, is what is it about wood aging and the maturation process in wood that is so fundamentally different from doing it in a stainless steel tank?
All of those things. I mean, the flavors that are generated by the wood itself, you know, whether it's the caramel, the coconut, the charred flavor, the spice, all that kind of thing, or the flavors that are resultant from the activities of lactobacillus and Brettanomyces and whatever else might be living in it. I mean, go ahead, take it. You can take it farther than that.
The idea that those things are living in a wooden barrel, I think, is kind of off most people's radar unless they really follow this part of the category, right?
Sure.
The idea that these things are hosting a microclimate is a kind of a bizarre idea.
Yeah, and there's a lot of romanticism involved in that where, this oak barrel influences the beer going into it, but in reality, it's also a big challenge because it's not something that's directly in your control. So we talked about earlier trying to control variables with, you know, having a neutral environment, as neutral an environment as possible for oak. But at the same time, we're kind of always fighting a losing battle, and that's the nature of sour beer. And when people who aren't as familiar with sour beer making, when I get a chance to talk to them, I just tell them you're playing a different game. You know, if you're used to football and there's, 100 yards and here's where the goalposts are, it's like you just move the goalposts into the stands and you're kind of like, wait, how do we do this? And you just figure it out. It's very inefficient and it's a different ball game altogether.
And along the way, you get to know specific barrels for what they're able to produce in terms of, flavors and aromas and textures in the beers that you're trying to make. I know at New Belgium, it's a big part of some of those fooders, which are larger and have a more singular presence, I would say, in the program than any one barrel might amongst hundreds. But still, you kind of get to know what's possible within those barrels and where they're going based on what they produce. How does that over time... It seems like over time it becomes a little bit more predictable in what you can get from a specific set of barrels. And then as a result, blending seems like it's a really critical part of the process to arrive at those predictable results. Like, it seems like there's a few different levers you can pull as a producer to try and arrive at some sort of finished intent or consistency in the finished product. How do you go about, I guess, kind of cataloging what's possible within specific wood environments, whether it's a fooder or a barrel, or how do you track that?
Well, Lauren's notebook is kind of legendary. Lauren Limbach, who's really in charge of the blending at New Belgium, she has a notebook that she tastes each of the fooders, I think, weekly, something like that, and writes notes about how they're coming along, and her notes are wonderful. And so in that way, she's tracking the progress of the flavors in each individual fooder over time.
And just in case anybody thinks it's really esoteric, like she's jotting down like really, really, some of them are just like, this one's awesome.
Yeah.
Smiley face.
She has a whole rating system that way. And we reproduced a page from her notebook in the book so that people could see the way her mind worked with that kind of stuff. And she also wrote, it was probably 2,500 words on her process for blending, because the book was really... We couldn't have done it without everybody else in the industry contributing, including Jay and Alex and you know, people from all over the place, you know, Cigar City and in Belgium as well, people giving us statements about the different kinds of things that they were doing. Lauren wrote this 2,500-word essay on how she blends and catalogs, and when I finished reading it, I cried. And I ran the whole thing. We printed the whole thing in the book.
So in the, I guess in the history of sour making, sour beer making in the U.S., New Belgium's on the older side, oldest continuous sour strain in the country by some accounts. I think by comparison, Rare Barrels is rather young, even though it's substantial.
Thank you.
I guess, how do you perceive your relationship with these barrels? Are they changing all the time? It seems like you're probably bringing in new batches of barrels as you can acquire them and mixing them in. How is the program of wood itself here on these rafters taking shape in your mind over time? Like, are you getting to know them? Is it constantly new? Are you struggling to keep track of what's going on in each individual barrel? I guess, like, how knowable is the system for you at the moment?
Manually, it is not very knowable because we have about 800 or 900 oak barrels in the building, and Lauren has gotten to know and even name her oak tanks, the fooders. And for us, we definitely need to take her inspiration from her notes, but scale that up to basically a 20 times factor, because we do view these all as their own individual personalities and the beer that they produce. So after a while, we needed to invest in barrel software, and a lot of what we do is just note-taking here. I like to say we're very much not like a normal brewery. 45% of what we do is preparation for what we're talking about doing. 45% is looking back and seeing what we could have done better, improvements, making sure we have all the information written down correctly. And 10% is the actual doing of whatever we need to do. So it is quite difficult, and it's a... We're not a very efficient brewery either. I'm just saying great things about us right now. But
well, what inspired you to go all in on this? I mean, it's a pretty big decision to do just sour barrel aged blending.
Yeah, not to be too grandiose about it, but we just feel like sour beer deserved it. It deserves attention. And when we started this 5 years ago, sour beers were popular, but they were hard to get. When we would visit other breweries, we would, you know, not the scale of New Belgium, because obviously they're a pioneer in sour beer making, but, you know, your regular brewery down the street, maybe they're dabbling in sour beer, and their oak barrels are tucked in the back of the brewery, and maybe they check on them every once in a while, and they don't really know what is going to become of it, or if they're good or not. You know, sour beer is not to be made in a crock pot. Set it and forget it. It needs attention. We don't understand this style of beer very well at this point as an industry, as a brewery, the Rare Barrel. So we decided to dedicate our focus to that. And then we also thought we could innovate because of our focus. So really focusing on just sour beer, a very niche thing. We believe that the constraint of that focus would breed creativity in ways that maybe it wouldn't otherwise. If you're at a brewery that's, you know, making a lot of IPA and you have four oak barrels tucked in the back and that's your sour program, that's great. You're going to make it an apricot sour or raspberry sour. Those are slam dunks. But how much innovating are you going to do? So we decided to fully invest in this. And it's certainly not, it doesn't come without its trials and folly, so to borrow another word from New Belgium.
Well, you've got a full tap room, so it seems like it's working okay.
Yeah.
Dick, as somebody who has both been a producer, a researcher, a writer about this category, how would you describe sort of where we're at on the potential timeline for the category?
Well, yeah, actually, as we were sitting here, I was trying to figure out sort of what generation we're at in terms of wood aging just to begin with. Because the very first wood-aged beers, I would say, I mean, at least in this country, embraced by craft brewers, were the bourbon barrel beers. You know, those were sort of obvious. You know, you could put a dark beer in a bourbon barrel and have this amazing alcoholic flavor, and you could bowl people over without a whole lot of effort.
Do people like that?
So maybe that's generation one. But I don't know. We're at least into three. Because people then started souring things. And
yeah, how would you characterize those three?
Well, I would say the first one is the bourbon barrel aged one. The second one is when people are doing a program kind of like what Jay just described on the very small scale,
having just a few in the back,
just
kind
doing
of
individual
side hobby.
Barrels. And when you empty a barrel, that's the beer you've got. I'd say generation three is blending. You know, that's when people started putting things together, recognizing that there was a different climate in each barrel or each container, and then coming up with combinations of what was going to be good. And also, you know, blending isn't just blending beer from barrels together. It can be blending beer from barrels into a more conventional beer to give it a new definition, a new life. There are all sorts of ramifications, but I mean, I'd say those are the first three generations. You think there's another one beyond that?
No, I think we're living on the edge of that. And like I was saying before, there's so much that isn't known. And I think blending is key, but I think also blending and innovation go hand in hand.
Yeah. Innovation, of course, is important for anything. And that's how you keep your company, your brewery, and your customers engaged. And it's essential.
So we've got a tap room right now full of people that have been blending their own sour and saison together. What is it about sour and saison that seems so blendable? Why are those the two things that we're talking about all the time when we talk about blending? What's the natural relationship that those things have?
You know, that's a very good question. And that's code word for I don't know. But one thing that struck me when you asked that, Michael, was that I felt myself floating back to, you know, 2, 3, 4, 16 previous lives. And maybe I was around for the first beer ever produced. And I bet that was most accurately classified as a sour saison. It was uncontrolled fermentation. It was made in a vessel that the gods had blessed and turned
probably
it into
a very artisanal bucket.
Yep. And what were the grains that they used? It was seasonal grains, whatever was local. So local, funky, and seasonal, I think, defines tart saison for thousands of years. And maybe we're just all right now rediscovering this beverage that links us to the past. Maybe that's overly romanticized, but
sure,
I think it sounds pretty
sure
cool.
Sure it is, but that's fine.
Dick, what relationship do you see between, maybe we don't have to talk about the beer specifically, but maybe the broader context of sour and saison? What is it we're trying to achieve with these styles that gives them a natural relationship to each other?
I think back to when the very first sour beer I ever drank, which was just a regular Rodenbach, sometime in the late 80s, and the first sip was an assault. You know, because it was so unexpected. I just didn't know what to expect about that. And I had to set it down and think about it. It took me about 45 minutes to drink it, but by the time I was done, I thought it was one of the most interesting beers I'd ever had. So I think there's sort of there's something really sort of naturally appealing about sour beers. I think, you know, it appeals to a different part of the palate and a different part of the brain, maybe, the different part of the tasting mechanism than a more conventional beer will. But it just clicks. And once you've got that affinity, there's really no turning back. So I think it's about the cultivation of an affinity. And thankfully, more and more people are taking that on. I mean, I can't tell you how many people walk up to our bar and say, what do you have that's sour? And now, fortunately, we're pouring the New Belgium beers at Magnolia. And, you know, later we'll be generating our own. We'll see how that goes. I think it's affinity.
We talk a lot, I think, in the sour beer niche, we talk a lot about what good and bad the word sour does for everybody, right? There's some folks that don't like the word. There's some folks that love the word. They find it helpful. Some people find it problematic. The word saison, though, is as long as it's been around for a long time, but not a lot of people really kind of understand what a saison is supposed to be. And most of them now, most drinkers in the U.S., especially younger ones, are having their first Saison from the brewery down the street, not necessarily a DuPont or something from the Wilonia Valley. What would you like American consumers in an ideal state to be finding in the first Saison they have? What are the characteristics that we should be looking for that will help us sort of like understand what a Saison is, you know, ideally supposed to be like?
Well, Jay was talking earlier about just how slippery the definition of Saison is. I mean, it really doesn't mean anything. I mean, it means all the things that Jay said, but, you know, it was what was produced in any given place, and the Saison that's produced down the road is very different. And yet, we do sort of have some benchmarks that we sort of think of in connection with them. I'd say, you know, you're going to look for some yeast character. You're going to look for some phenolic character from probably a warmish fermentation. You're going to look for complexity that a conventional beer doesn't have because there's more than one yeast, more than one microorganism conducting the fermentation. And then, you know, the field for Saison is so wide open that you can add just about anything to it, whether it's a fruit or an herb or some kind of aging technique in wood or something like that. So it can have all those things too. I think what it does is it just sort of alerts the consumer to the idea that there will be something interesting going on in this beer.
Something indescribable too. And, you know, we talk about blending. I think this isn't traditionally thought of as blending, but Saison aromatics can run the gamut of very fruity to very spicy phenolic. And you can blend even Saison strains or manipulate fermentation temperature or your grist to support the idea of the beer that you're going to be making later on. And, you know, Saison representing seasons, seasonality. Maybe you want to make an apricot Saison. So you actually intentionally, instead of doing a same blending or theoretical blending of what you want to produce as a beer, you want to contrast that with maybe a little spiciness, more of the phenolic end of the spectrum, to balance out the sweet fruitiness of the ingredient you're going to be adding. So that's more of like a theoretical future flavor blending, but I think Saison is well suited to support seasonal ingredients, pair with seasonal ingredients, and just basically be the best beer to have with food, and way better than wine.
Absolutely.
Hot take.
Still need those wine barrels. For the folks that are out here blending their own sour and Saison together right now and kind of tasting the results of that and probably evaluating on a personal level whether they like it or not, what in your mind constitutes a well-blended beer? What are some of the aspects or characteristics of a blend that you're evaluating it on as a brewer?
I'll start on this one. Blending to me is a very interesting dichotomy of extremely simple and an extremely complex process, both at the same time. We take a lot of individual components, and it's as simple as a go, no-go situation. But then we evaluate the blend once we combine them, and the whole is always more than the sum of its parts. And some, and I'm not into this sort of thing, but like mystical, magical way, it's really true. Two beers blended together can really make something that neither of them had or both of them had, and now they're turned up a little bit. And that's the complex side of things. But the individual evaluation of samples is actually pretty simple. It's, do I like this? Do I not like this? And then going back to the complementary or contrasting flavor profiles, you basically just, it's trial by error. You blend two fruity things together and you're like, hey, I'm into this. It's super fruity. Or you're like, oh, that's a little too fruity. Maybe I should balance it out with something else. And it allows you to go a different direction. Having 800-900 oak barrels, we can get really into the nitty-gritty details with blending. Sometimes I wish I had, you know, large oak tanks. So it's just like, all right, that one and that one. Let's do it.
So you do about a few dozen different beers a year that are all blended to some degree or another. Roughly speaking, how many unique barrels are we talking about that go into a specific blend? And how wide of a range is there between different blends?
So all the barrels are unique, but there are groups that are more similar than others. They came from the same initial primary fermentation. But I talked about experimentation before. We'll do a 30-barrel batch of, let's say, base saison, and that'll yield us around 16 oak barrels or so, give or take a few. And what we'll do is we'll take four, and maybe we'll treat those oak barrels and clean them out very well, and then inoculate those with a certain strain of Brettanomyces. Then the next four we'll have just emptied a beer, and we're just going to put beer right back on it. So those four represent their own microculture. And then the next four, we will cold rinse the barrels. So we're not killing any of the yeast and bacteria, but we're inhibiting it slightly. That's another mini experiment. And then the next four, maybe we'll dry hop or something like that. So basically, inside of this initial 30-barrel batch, we're breaking things out, and then we'll break those out a little bit more. And again, getting back to what I was saying before about the rare barrel and pH 1, we're just looking for a lightning strike where, wow, this oak barrel is wonderful. Then we have to go back and look, how did we get here?
Does that barrel get like its own special place after that? Does it like graduate to a different area of the brewery?
Yes. I mean, that is what the search for the rare barrel is about for us. We do that every couple of years, and we just finished our second round of that. That barrel gets packaged on its own, and then we reuse the yeast and bacteria in that barrel to influence other barrels around the brewery. So we're always trying to move forward on that.
It's like racehorses.
Yep.
Basically.
Yeah.
Thinking about the future of the category a little bit, just to round out the last couple of minutes here, what do you think some of the factors are that are going to play into the size of this niche, the excitement around it, and where it might be going next? What are some of the things that feel like it could potentially be that fourth generation influence on what sour and saison is going to be? Are we seeing something unique from the people who are seeking these beers out? Do we think it'll ever become, I mean, do we think sour and saison is going to become a mainstream attraction in beer, or is it destined to be a niche forever?
I think in some ways it's destined to be a niche because just the volumes that we're talking about. I mean, yes, 800 or 900 barrels sounds like a lot, but compared to even a medium-sized production brewery, it's not that much beer. New Belgium's wood beer, you could walk through that room and, you know, the 60 or 70 fooders that are there seem like an incredible amount of beer, but it's not. And this is one thing that I find really comforting, because it means that it can't be appropriated by the big brewers because it won't pay. I mean, they've of course appropriated some sour beer producers and all that, but it can't be a money product for them.
Yeah. AB just brought back the Bellevue Lambic brand. It's going to be interesting.
I read that on a really wonderful website. Good Beer Hunting.
But the next generation, I mean...
But you're right. They can't really scale it to any reasonable degree.
Yeah, they can't. But the next generation, I mean, maybe that's what we're thinking about doing by bringing Lambic beer from Belgium to blend with stuff that we do and stuff that our friends do. I mean, it really is a wonderful community of people. And we're always helping each other and working together. And these guys have been really open-hearted and... you know, with knowledge and everything else, and I'm going to need that because I don't know how to do this yet.
We don't either.
When we're talking about something that relies on sort of this natural organic process of microbiology, you know, you're talking about the health of the climate, you're talking about temperature changes. We're in a very large space right now that you couldn't possibly control the climate up to any reasonable degree.
Pun intended.
How is climate going to change the way these beers are made around the country? How does that factor into the future of this niche? Have you had to make any adjustments over time just in the fluctuation of seasons and temperature here in the Bay?
I'm not sure I can accurately say that, oh, this oak barrel, we need to dump because of temperature fluctuations. There's so many variables around that that I couldn't say, but yeah, I mean, people are making sour beer all over the country, all over the world, and many of the best sour beer producers are in climates where I would not start a sour brewery because of the difficulties, but they do it and they pull it off. And I think that's one of the tenets of innovation, is innovation because of circumstance. And I think that drives a lot of the history of innovation and invention, is that you're forced into a situation that you have to overcome and you learn something from it and maybe produce something totally beautiful and unexpected. And so who's to say what the ideal situation is? I mean, if we all just rested on our laurels and said, let's just make sour beer the way it's been made, you know, we'd all have to have cool ships and we'd all be in Brussels right now.
Sure.
So, but here we are.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was getting started as a brewer, the word was that spontaneous fermentation only worked in one place in the world. It was in the Seine Valley in Belgium. That was the only place it would work. Any place else that it had ever been tried, it made terrible beer and it didn't work. And we know now that that is totally not true.
That was a good. That was a pretty good counterintelligence campaign by the Belgians, however.
Yeah. Well, spontaneous. You know, for something that's named spontaneous, there sure are a lot of rules around it.
That's right. Well, and the thing about climate change, like anything that changes incrementally, it's difficult for to sort of pick up on that, especially with an unsophisticated political sensibility.
I'm not adding to that. Thank you very much. It's been a joy having you. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening this week, folks. This past week, we published a message in a bottle story from Matthew Curtis as part of our series in collaboration with Brewery Oma Gang, exploring the state of Belgian brewing. This one looks at how the term Belgian itself went from being an experimental approach to a sort of fundamental ethos in the US over the years. And from Brian Roth, our Sightlines editor, we have a story on yeast, looking at the intellectual property, manipulation, and marketing of one of the beer's most fundamental ingredients. Brian also takes a close look at the challenges of distribution restrictions in Florida that are leaving some brewers with limited to no access to market. And this week, I share a personal story myself, outlining my own journey into the world of beer and other fermented beverages, highlighting the people along the way who have made a lasting impression on my palate and my imagination. You can read that story on my Sorry for Partying blog on GBH. And the Fervent Few chimed in with their perspectives on beer trading, why they do or don't engage in the practice, and how it's changed in recent years. I learned so much from this group of subscribers, and this is no exception. If you weren't already aware, we started a subscription club for GBH readers called The Fervent Few, where you can contribute financially to the content you love and get access to exclusive gear, our community forum, and we invite you to share your experiences and opinions on a weekly topic. It's been a great way to bring our readers together with our writers for some compelling discussion. You should join. If you'd like to support GBH, visit goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew or click on the link in our show notes. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.